call to order. Present on the committee, Representative Keller, Representative Holmes, Representative Thompson, and myself, Chair Gatto. I see that Representative Lynn has just arrived, so add him. Cell phones, off position.
Yes.
We're going to cover three bills today. I think we'll get to all of them. 133, House Bill, increasing the number of Superior Court judges. We'll do that first. Secondly, we'll do a House Bill 150, protection of vulnerable adults and minors. I'm going to cut that off at 2:15 so that we can get to House Bill 127, crimes involving minors, stalking, etc. So first up is increasing the number of Superior Court judges, House Bill 133. We have to bring it up. There were a couple of things that couldn't pass it out earlier until we made some corrections. They're both corrections on the fiscal note, not corrections on the substance. The numbers stay the same except for one of the fiscal notes. So for committee members, fiscal note for the Alaska court system, if you get to that one, it looks like is 23.2. The only changes we've made were technical. That is, if you look at the OMB component number, which is 771, previously we had an incorrect number. We made that change. And then just three lines above that, we had to add that this is, the department is the Alaska court system. Actually, that we didn't think that was absolutely accurate because we thought the judicial council had acted independent of that, but we were advised that it would be better to put that in. Any questions, gentlemen, ladies? No questions. I'm going to go on to the second fiscal note, which is Department of Corrections. That is a number change. The original number we had, I forget what was the original number, but anyway, the new number is zero. So the fiscal note from Department of Corrections is now zero. Is there any questions from the committee? Those changes were essential. At this point, Representative Thompson or Representative Keller or anyone else, I will entertain a motion to move House Bill 133 from committee. Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move House Bill 133-27-LS-0473-A from committee with
individual recommendations
and fiscal notes.
And I don't know if we need to say as amended.
Yeah, we did that.
So as amended, is there an objection? We're joined by Representative Gruenberg. We now have three, four, five, six members here, and Representative Pruitt will be here shortly, and we'll have the full committee. But I think it's fair to say if there are no objections on moving House Bill 133. Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 133 moves from committee. And take a short at ease while we pass around the We will cover now House Bill 150, protection of vulnerable adults and minors. As I mentioned, I wanted to finish this one by about 2:15 so we can deal with amendments on the last bill. Lots of amendments, and we'll just need some time to cover it. We have a lot of people to testify in this one. This is sponsor of this bill is rules chair by request of the governor. Introduction will be by Dwayne Mays, Director of Health Social Services, Seniors and Disability Services. Please come forward. Introduce yourself so we know who you are for the help of the secretary who's trying to keep records of who said it, when they said it, and who are they? Who are they associated with? So please, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dwayne Mays, and I'm the director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. First, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to present on this bill. For the Division of Senior Disability Services, we have the Adult Protective Services Unit, and you'll be hearing a little bit about that later in our testimony. Today, we are going to be presenting on House Bill 150, which relates to the protection of vulnerable adults who are people with disabilities in Alaska and 65 and older. Specifically, this bill relates to the protection of property as well as the crime of violating a protective order. So with me today, I have Kelly Hendrickson behind me from law. She's the Assistant Attorney General with the Human Services Section. She's going to come to the table and do a sectional analysis. I have Scott Sterling, who's the Supervising Attorney for the Office of Elder Fraud with the Department of Administration, so he will be at the table as well. The two of them are very intimate with this bill. They know a lot about it, so we presented to the Senate side on Monday, and they did a really good job of that. So we do have others here as well to answer any questions. We have Rachel Levitt with the Department of Administration. She's the Director of the Office for Public Advocacy. We have Beth Russo, Public Guardian Supervisor with that same office. And to my right, we have Joanne Gibbons, who's the Deputy Director for the Division of Senior Disability Services. And I believe we have online Brenda Malatini, who is the lead to our Adult Protective Services Unit and knows quite a bit about this business. So my focus today is just to give you a very quick general overview, and then others will come to the table and talk about the details of this bill. So what will this bill do? We know that financial exploitation of the elder and other vulnerable populations is a problem in this state. It is growing along with the growth in our elderly population. The Alaska Department of Labor estimates that we have around 50 to 60,000 seniors in this state, 60 and older. The demographic, we believe, will exceed that to 80,000 by the year 2017. So just to give you kind of an idea of the population that we're talking about. House Bill 150 will strengthen Alaska laws by doing a better job of protecting elders and other vulnerable populations in the state from fraud and financial exploitation. Vulnerable adults need assistance in stopping immediate misuse, the theft of their money, and that's key to this bill. House Bill 150 will address the frustrations that victims often feel in accessing the courts and obtaining prompt and inexpensive relief. So there are two keys to this bill that our attorneys will be talking about. The two types of emergency procedures that will allow the courts to quickly act to protect vulnerable adults from financial abuse. The first is the temporary conservatorship provision of this bill. It'll help victims of financial exploitation who may not need a guardian but may need assistance on stopping immediate misuse of theft of their money. The temporary conservatorship procedure will work much as the same as an existing temporary guardian procedure that is already in statute. The vulnerable victim will retain autonomy while receiving assistance, thus enhancing the ability of the victim to stop exploitation or loss before suffering irreparable harm. So that's the first piece, the conservatorship. The second emergency procedure is the ex parte relief from fraud, which is similar to existing domestic violence protection law. This ex parte relief provision of House Bill 150 will allow vulnerable adults to independently obtain straightforward, expedited relief without a lawyer from any magistrate or judge throughout the state. So just a couple more pieces of this bill. It'll amend the Adult Protective Services statutes in order to protect additional protection to vulnerable adults by enhancing their investigatory authority. So for APS, that's crucial. This bill will expand the list of mandatory reporters to include employees of nursing homes. This bill would add the concept of undue influence, and we'll talk a lot about that. When a person of trust uses their role to exploit and gain control over a vulnerable adult.
Can you define a person of trust for us?
Through the chair, if you wouldn't mind, I would like to leave that to our attorneys.
Sitting behind you.
Behind me.
Yeah, thank
yes.
You.
You have a platoon.
We have two attorneys, yes.
You do.
This bill will enhance penalties in criminal cases where there is abuse of an elderly victim. So in summary, we believe that this bill will provide the state of Alaska the tools needed to combat this growing problem of financial abuse in our elderly and disability populations. So with that, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to invite Kelly Henriksen and Scott Sterling to the table.
Okay. So you've concluded your testimony?
That's correct.
Thank you. Yeah, why don't the two of you come to the table, and you got a couple chairs there, and share the microphone. And I believe Kelly is going to do a sectional analysis, point by point by point by point by point.
Ad infinitum.
And just before we start, Scott, can you, person of trust, where does that start?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Scott Sterling, Supervising Attorney, State of Alaska, Office of Elder Fraud and Assistance. A person of trust in the law is usually defined as anyone with a trust or fiduciary responsibility. It may include, for example, a person who holds a power of attorney instrument, otherwise known as an attorney in fact, a lawyer, an accountant, a doctor. It can be anyone like that. It can also be defined to be an informal relationship between family members where, for example, one family member says, look, I'm not feeling very well, but I really need you to help me make sure my bills are paid for the next few weeks. I think I may have to go to the hospital. They may not sign anything, but that fiduciary relationship still exists. It's still a trust relationship.
Okay. State troopers, everybody that's official is
no,
a person of trust, or?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that it would include law enforcement agents or people who are discharging a public duty in that sense. But it would definitely include a guardian, a conservator, an attorney in fact, a lawyer, and
all parents
like
and
that.
Children or siblings?
Parents do stand in a fiduciary relationship to their children, but that gets into a whole separate area of the law that I'm not terribly qualified to talk about today. But
well, neither are we.
Yeah.
Well, we got a couple of attorneys here.
Yeah, there are attorneys in here, both in government and outside of government, who are experts in that field. But I'm not.
It's important for us to at least be able to grasp some of the terms ahead of time, so
yes,
we understand that everybody in this room doesn't fit that category, but maybe one of us does. Okay, Representative Grunberg.
Where does the term "person of trust" appear in the bill?
It was a statement.
I understand that, but is that a term that's in the bill?
It's on page 19, through the chair, Representative Grunberg. It's on page 19, which is the definitional section. If you look at line 11, it's subsection 20. In the bill, it says, quote, a person who stands in a position of trust or confidence, end quote, means a person who, A, is a relative by blood or marriage, B, is a joint tenant or tenant in common, C, has a legal or fiduciary relationship, or D, is a person who has been entrusted with or has assumed responsibility for the use or management of the vulnerable adult's assets or income.
So, if I may.
Please. Yeah.
To answer your question, Mr. Chair, the terms defined in the bill.
Got it.
Thank you.
Yes, and thank you.
I didn't know that. That was a good guess. Lucky. Let's be fair.
You knew right where to find it. I'm impressed.
Ms. Henriksen is...
page 19.
Mr. Chairman, if we may, what we've thought we would do is I will discuss the first eight sections of the bill that deal with Title 13, and then Ms. Henriksen will proceed to deal with the remaining sections that deal with the Adult Protective Services.
Okay, we'll go with that.
May I ask a preliminary question?
Representative Grunberg has a question.
My question was, and I assume that we can start from this as a starting point, that this bill has been carefully crafted to interface with 13.26.
Mr. Representative Grunberg, through the chair, yes. Sir,
good.
It has.
Has it been run by the probate section, or does it need to be?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, to my knowledge, it has not been run by any of the private bars probate sections. However, it has been discussed at the elder law.
Oh, okay.
Section. Yes.
Okay. So it's been run through the chair. So it's been run by the Bar Association Elder Law section.
So
sorry.
Or somebody.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. I was not at liberty to discuss this bill until it was formally announced by the governor's office and released. And once that permission was granted, I went proceeded to let everyone I could think of know that it had been put on the table.
And may I just follow up really briefly?
One more.
Just for the members' information, last year I spent some effort trying to get a liaison system set up with the private bar so that if we had issues relating to corporate law, we'd be able to draw on the best legal minds in the state, criminal law, elder law, or whatever. And I kind of fallen down on the job this time. They set up some liaisons last time, and we haven't followed through on that. But it sounds to me like you've done that as best you can on this bill, so you're getting input from practitioners in the area?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, what I have done is worked on this bill on the Title 13 sections in collaboration with my colleagues at the Department of Health and Social Services. But I did not go out and widely seek input from the private bar, I wish to be clear. The bill was only, I believe, released for publication or notice that it would be introduced very shortly ahead of the session commencing.
If I may just, are you planning to follow up and get input from those folks? I'm not criticizing or anything. I don't want somebody coming in at the last minute and saying, hey, we never heard about this. If you could just get the word out.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I will do my best to discuss it with my colleagues in the elder law and probate bar.
And this bill will not be leaving the committee today, so we have some time.
Yeah, thank you. And I know Mr. Sterling is a well-respected, longtime member of the bar, and I know you are too. And
this is scary for the rest of us that aren't attorneys, you know.
She's looking over her shoulder. No, but that's great. And I'm just kind of sort of indicating I'll be asking from time to time folks the same question because we want to get the best minds we can.
Thank okay. You. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, for the record, my name is Scott Sterling, and I'm here to give the perspective of a sectional analysis on House Bill 150 as it relates to the first eight sections of the bill. I'll be happy to answer questions as we proceed or whatever the chair and the committee wish to do. Section 1 of the bill makes a knowing violation or attempted violation of a financial protective order, which is introduced in Section 7 of the bill, to protect vulnerable adults and elders. It makes violation of such an order an offense, a criminal offense.
In my section, it uses the word a crime.
It is a crime, yes.
And so a criminal offense, a crime.
Yes.
And I know this is not official, it's just the analysis, but
yes.
Just so those of us, I mean, a crime, I guess, covers a violation up to a felony.
It's a misdemeanor, Mr. Chairman.
A crime is a misdemeanor?
The violation of the order would be deemed a misdemeanor under Title 11.
I was thinking of just the word crime. Crime covers beyond a misdemeanor?
Crime covers, in Alaska law, crime covers generally in general terms. We have Class B misdemeanors, Class A misdemeanors. We have A, B, and C felonies, and then we have unclassified felonies. Below a Class B misdemeanor, which is the lowest criminal offense, you may also have violations. Those pertain mostly to traffic, licensing violations, and things of that nature.
Littering.
Yes, and then you have municipal laws, which use different definitions.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
Section 2 amends the definition of protective orders found in Alaska Statute 1156740 to include financial protective orders being introduced with this legislation to protect the financial security of vulnerable adults and elders. Section 3 makes the fact that a defendant knowingly directs criminal conduct at a person 65 years of age or older an aggravating factor at sentencing. And that would apply across the board to any person convicted of a crime where the victim is identified as being 65 or older. Then the prosecution may allege an aggravator, and the court may, if it finds that aggravator, assign the appropriate weight to it to reflect the fact that the victim may have been more vulnerable due to age.
Representative Gruenberg?
This was interesting to me, and I spent a fair amount of time looking at Section 3 of the bill. There is in Title 12, point 55, point 155, which is the sentence, the statute that deals with aggravators and mitigators, things that can increase the sentence or decrease the sentence. There are zillions of them. That's not literally true, but they're an awful lot.
That's an undefined term.
President Bush said something about that. I can't think. Okay. I do remember. There is already an aggravator with respect to age. And, Scott, do you know where that is in this, which subsection that is in sub C?
I don't have a copy of 125.55 before me, I'm sorry.
What it did, it said that if it's an aggravator, here we go, it's sub 5, may I read that?
Please.
It's an aggravator if the defendant knew or reasonably should have known, that the victim of the offense was particularly vulnerable or incapable of resistance due to advanced age, disability, ill health, homelessness, which we added a couple of years ago, consumption of alcohol or drugs, or extreme youth, or was for any other reason substantially incapable of exercising normal physical or mental powers of resistance. This, for the first time, makes it a per se, in and of itself, aggravator if they knowingly directed the conduct constituting the offense at a victim because that person was 65 years of age or older. As you can see, if you think about this, there are a number of inconsistencies between the language in the bill and the aggravator. First of all, you don't have to find there's a vulnerability factor. Secondly, this uses the term advanced age. This uses the term age 65 or over. And knowingly, as opposed to knew or reasonably should have known. And since we're not going to move the bill today, what I would like to do is to talk with you folks. I'm looking at Mr. Sterling and the folks from the commission, how this will interface with sub 5. And frankly, I was interested, Mr. Chair, in seeing, since this gets into aggravators, and we have some other bills that are looking at increasing the number of protected classes, I was thinking this bill, governor's bill, might be a vehicle for looking at a broader amendment. I don't know that I want to do that because this is dealing with age only. But I do think we have to look at the interface between the new 35 and subsection 5. And I hope you folks will take the opportunity to talk with us in our office. Thank you for letting me have a soliloquy there.
Mr. Sterling, 65 a magic number that is defined somewhere or so generally accepted that if you want to go to the movies and you're 65, you're going to get a discount. You don't have to be 70, I'm guessing.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the age 65 was selected because of it could have just as easily been 60.
How long is 60? Considering that we seem to be doing better as time goes on, it's like Social Security where you're supposed to have deceased at a certain age and doggone it, you're still around. Is this was this an old number that we've been tossing around for a few decades that maybe should be older now?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't frankly know the answer to that. That's a very good question. I do know that in the elder fraud statute, the legislature set the threshold at age 60. And I think it's because people are retiring sooner and finding that...
Are we actually retiring sooner or later? I keep thinking this is a bad economy. You can't kick people out of their job anymore.
Well, that was 7 years ago, or some years ago when it was passed.
Before the collapse, yeah. Okay.
I know 65 is generally adhered to or referred to because of its use in federal Social Security legislation and military retirements and things like that.
And is 65 in Social Security legislation the highest number? I mean, there's you can go at 62, you can go at 65. Is 70 available where you get some more points or something? Oh, it is?
That is true, sir. Yes, you can choose to retire at a much later age, and in fact it has benefits for you if you do wait.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you. Representative Lynn.
I'm 78, and all kinds of things are aggravators to me.
I hope you don't mean us.
No.
Representative Grunberg.
This is one of the few bills, well, I guess we have one or two every session, dealing with something with aging. But you've raised a really interesting question, and I think it would be worthwhile for somebody to make a study present to the legislature. The statutes, state laws, mm-hmm. that deal with ages and the legal thresholds, and we ought to see what they are and see if they're inconsistent, and that would probably be something within the purview of this committee, and it might be something that we could have, I'm going to use as an example another section in the bill, directing that a study be conducted by the Commission on Aging to look at all the state laws and the different ages and what the policies are, and to make appropriate recommendations to the legislature whether any of these are out of sync.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're back on the
air. Mr. Chairman, I'll then refer to Section 4 of the bill. This section adds being a victim of fraud as a basis for appointing a conservator by amending Alaska Statute 1326.1652A. This will allow courts to protect individuals who may not be suffering from any mental deficiency but are victims of financial abuse. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'll expound on this just briefly. This is here because we don't have an explicit temporary conservator provision in Title 13. We have an explicit temporary guardian provision, but we have no counterpart for conservators. And what the experience in handling actual cases has been showing is that many times a vulnerable adult or an elder will seek assistance in stopping financial exploitation because they're unable to manage their own affairs. They're having trouble for whatever the reason may be. It may be a temporary thing. It may be the insidious effects of dementia, which start slowly but worsen as time goes on. It may be a medical emergency. It may be any number of things. Those are often the times when a perpetrator will seek to take advantage of the vulnerable adult's situation. And if that person is operating from a position of trust and confidence, then they are able to readily exploit the elder or vulnerable adult's position. To put a stop to that, particularly if the person holds a legal instrument such as a power of attorney, you need the power of the court to intercede, to revoke that power of attorney, to freeze the situation, to stabilize the elder or vulnerable adult's position. It doesn't mean that they need a guardian. They are probably well able to make the health, medical, life, safety decisions that they need. But what they can't do is manage their money so as to prevent a trusted person from abusing them. The temporary conservator provision, as it's used or utilized in almost all of our sister states, speaks to these sort of emergency or exigent or urgent situations where you're not going to need a full-time or professional guardian, but you're going to need the power of the court with court oversight over a conservator to stop the abuse, preserve the evidence, stabilize the situation, and hopefully, if not prevent mm-hmm. the exploitation, begin the process of curing it. And that's really at the heart of the temporary conservator amendments that this bill would enact if passed.
I was a little curious about the last line in that sentence we just discussed. To protect individuals, and it says, who may not be suffering from any mental deficiency but are victims of financial abuse.
Yes.
And I'm looking at the part that says, from any mental deficiency. We have kids who can't pass the GED, have trouble with all subject matter, can feed themselves and generally survive. At some point, are they qualifying under mental deficiency?
Mr. Chairman, my information and understanding is that assessing competency is primarily a legal as opposed to medical decision-making process, but that assessing mental disease or defect is a medical as opposed to legal process.
Okay, got it. And for the record, we've been joined by Representative Pruitt. So, Mr. Sterling, I'm sorry, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of conservatorships and guardianships, and I'm not sure whether this is more specific to Section 4 or whether it might fall somewhere else, but in conversations I was having with some people over the interim, it was brought to my attention that there's guardianships and there's conservatorships, and this might be part of what is helpful for us as a committee to kind of understand the difference. And I've been told that in one, I think it's in guardianships, the person, if the court is going to order a guardianship or a conservatorship, in one of the two cases, the person has the right to go in front of a jury to actually say, no, I am competent to deal with my own affairs. And in the other, they don't have the right to a jury trial, and that there may be some, you know, most people aren't going to want to go in front of a jury, but for the one person who really does care, who really does say, no, I really am competent to manage my own affairs. I shouldn't be in this situation. That might be an important right. Can you, one of you, explain that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, it's a very good question. Yes, in under Title 13, a person known as the respondent for whom a guardianship is sought by reason of a petition being filed has a right to contest that petition if they so choose or are able to choose. And if they so choose, they may ask the court to set it on for a jury trial. The reasoning is that there is a significant constitutional liberty interest in the autonomy of a citizen being able to choose life, health, and safety for themselves. And therefore, if a petitioner, which could be any person really, seeks to infringe on that liberty interest, then by asking for a full guardianship, then a jury trial is granted. With conservatorships, the liberty interest is not deemed to be as significant as life, health, and safety, those fundamental decisions. And I'm not aware of any reported opinion of the Supreme Court that says one has a right to a jury trial in a conservatorship proceeding. In most cases, I wouldn't say all, but in most cases, when a petition is filed, it's because the respondent, him or herself, wants it to be filed, unless they're so lacking in capacity that some other third party has to make that difficult decision. Mm-hmm. As Ms. Henriksen can elucidate further, the Adult Protective Services Agency and other state agencies sometimes, or non-government social service agencies, sometimes have to file petitions because it doesn't seem like there's anything else left to do that would help someone. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, your question about competency in relation to mental disease or defect, a very common fact pattern, I hope this helps, a very common fact pattern is someone who's having an urgent physical problems such as having to be hospitalized for a procedure and simultaneously suffering from the progressively worsening effects of dementia. they're alert and well enough to understand that they need to be treated, and they can converse with their doctor. They can make the decisions they need about, am I going to have this surgery or this procedure? But they can't get a grasp on what's in my checking account. Who has my ATM card? How are my utility bills going to be paid? And that is a very common fact pattern where you see this interplay of factors coming together, and the vulnerable adult or the elder is sort of left in the air. If they're being financially exploited at that point, I think any person of conscience who cares about them will want to have this petition procedure available to go in front of a judge and say, look, they're good, they're fine at making the medical decision. They need a lot of help because I think they're being exploited. I hope that helps. I'm sorry.
That helps a lot, Mr. Chairman, if I may follow up. That makes a lot of sense, and that helped me clarify. I guess my follow-up question for that would be, what about if it's the case where maybe the adult, we all know families are complicated. What about the cases in which we all know happen, you got the kids, or you got the grandkids, or you've got the brother or sister or whoever who comes in and says, yeah, grandma's really not competent to manage her money anymore. Maybe grandma really is. What do you do? I mean, for the ability to, you know, I want the safeguards in there. So I'm just trying to get a grasp on how do we make sure that the vulnerable adults are taken care of, but that you don't have people taking advantage of them by trying to set up a conservatorship when they don't want one. And if you could elaborate on that a little, that's sort of the other side of the coin.
Representative Holmes, through the chair, that's a very good question. The answer is that the court procedure calls for a court visitor to be appointed. Mm-hmm. The court visitor is an independent, arm's length, eyes and ears of the court. And the court visitor will be appointed under our rules of probate procedure and our statutes to independently investigate and verify the allegations and facts that are being brought forward. Normally, in a case that a petition is filed by my office or the Adult Protective Services Agency through the Attorney General, we will rely heavily upon giving input to the court visitor, including there will be a lengthy list of all known relevant contacts to be made. It'll include caseworkers, family members, physicians, anyone who has good, reliable knowledge of the situation. The court visitor's report is the first step in screening and defining what the facts are. Next, you have the hearing itself, where the court, and I think we can all say in our experience, we're usually questioned very, the petitioners are questioned very closely by the probate masters and the judges about what is really happening here, what are you trying to accomplish, and why. And this is because Title 13 gives a preference to autonomy over safety. It's called the least restrictive alternative. The courts are required to only impose the least restrictive alternative that infringes upon a person's autonomy. And hand in hand with that is the kind of questioning and inquiry that I talked about. So that it is theoretically possible that someone could attempt to manipulate and abuse the system. If experience counts, what I can say is my experience has been that it's not people trying to use the system to create a, you know, patina of legality for themselves. It's more that they already have it. They already have some existing legal authority, and with that comes the power to conceal what they're doing. And that's far more common. And it's only when someone is at rope's end that you see the petition being filed, because inexplicably the elder had $150,000 in their savings account 6 months ago and now they have nothing. Now, it's possible that was all spent legitimately. One of the functions of a court visitor would be to come to my office or APS or whoever might be handling that, a private attorney, and say, were you able to subpoena the financial records? Were you able to really see what happened? And sorry, I'm just, I feel like I'm consuming all of our time. I apologize.
Well, I don't think you can because we're coming back.
Okay. Yeah. May I comment?
Yeah.
My name's Kelly Hendrickson. I'm an assistant attorney general. I represent Department of Health and Social Services and Adult Protective Services. And in that role, I conduct guardianships and conservatorships in Southeast Alaska. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, I'm thinking of two questions that you've asked. The first one is that on the question of a jury trial, it's only on the question of incapacity in a guardianship. It's not on the second part of it, which is should a guardian be appointed and who is that guardian going to be. And as to sorting out the he said, she said situations, I don't want to forget the important part of APS's role in doing its investigation. Often it can sort out the he said, she said. It wouldn't be as neutral necessarily in terms of the court's eyes with respect to the court visitor, but a lot of work can be done by the APS investigator. And part of the reason we're advancing this bill is that it will strengthen the investigatory powers of APS to be able to sort out those situations so that if a case can be disposed of short of a petition, then we can do that. That's usually in the best interest of the respondent. Thank you.
You're welcome. Questions from the committee, Representative Lynn.
Well, I guess I just want some clarification. I was involved in a situation in California where I lived previously. I had a conservator of the estate, conservator of the person. The estate was the financial matter, and the person was the personal matter. That's the same thing we're talking about here with different terms.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, under Alaska law, a conservator, as the law now exists, would we be responsible for both property and any related financial affairs? If it's a health-related or safety or life situation, most likely our courts would appoint a guardian to make those kinds of decisions. Our distinctions tend to say conservators are for financial matters only, and guardians are for anything related to life, health, safety.
And I suppose that would be what we had in California as conservators of the person. Here in Alaska, it would be the guardian.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I'm guessing you're probably correct, although I don't know California law. I'm sorry. But
there's time.
No more bar exams for me.
Yeah, yeah, fun one. Good
luck. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple things in the technical wording of the bill. The term fraud is used, but as those of us who follow the news reports of the recent revelations concerning one individual exerting undue influence over another and getting all of his money, you probably all read that on the front page, should we not add after fraud or somewhere in there undue influence? Because those terms are different legally. You could have somebody who has the same result, taking somebody else's property or damaging it or whatever, not just due to fraud, which is a misrepresentation, but due to undue influence, which is a type of coercion or duress. What do you folks think, through the chair, adding undue influence?
Well, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, if you'll look at page 11, line 25 of House Bill 150, you I beg your pardon. In subsection 3, it states, in cases involving fraud, the department or its designee, etc., may make a report to the department under Title 47 to the Office of Public Advocacy for investigation. In this paragraph, fraud has the meaning given in AS 1326.325. And so that definition is incorporated by reference, the one that already exists in Title 13 in the definition section.
Mm-hmm.
And also financial exploitation is defined with reference to the elder fraud authorizing statute, which also includes a definition the legislature enacted when it passed that statute.
So does the term undue influence, is that appear? 1326325, is that the section?
It should be the definition of fraud.
Yep. 1326325.
Okay, 1326325. I don't see. That must be a new section here.
It's a section that's added by.
By the bill?
By the bill.
Oh, okay, because it's not in there.
Right.
Where is that? What page are we on for that?
That's at page 11.
1326.
Line 27. The section's added on page 6. I'm sorry.
Okay. Fraud means robbery, extortion, or coercion, criminal. Theft and related offenses, or exploitation for the personal profit or advantage with no significant benefit accruing to the person. I see. So you believe that the current definitions as proposed in Section 8 will cover the waterfront for undue influence, right?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I do.
Okay.
And because there's two definitional strongholds, if you will. One is the definitions that are included in the criminal law are brought to bear, and the other is the definition from the elder fraud statute is incorporated here so that there's a consistency in the definition.
The problem that I had noticed, and I was looking this up for some other reason a week or so ago, my recollection is that the crimes of coercion and extortion largely related to pressure for monetary gain as opposed to some pressure to make somebody do something illegal, for example, that did not have a monetary motive but could be done for malice or abuse or something. And it's only tangentially related, but it looked to me like I should take another look at those. But I'm going to pass to my second question here. And that is the use of the term, which is not changed in the bill, on page 3, line 1, quote, advanced age. You could have somebody who is acting, I'm on page 3, line 1 of the bill. It's already in 1326.165, may appoint a conservator or other protective order for causes follows appointment of the conservator, may be made in relation to the estate and affairs of a person if the court determines that, quote, advanced age effectively impairs that the person's unable to manage the person's property and affairs due to, quote, advanced age. Somebody, in my opinion, I mean, as I try and think of a hypothetical, might have an age-related disability that might be a minority, an infancy in the term that's traditionally infancy and incompetency. Mm-hmm. So you could have somebody who is under a disability, but because they're so young rather than that they're so old. And I'm just wondering, should we be looking in this bill at possibly removing the word advanced so that the court would have the authority under this provision here to enter a protective order for a person who was sufficiently young to require that? And the answer to that would seem to be probably yes, unless there's some other statutes that in 1326 already cover it. And I think there might be, we're dealing with the minority, but you could have somebody who's of a young age but may not technically be under the age of 18. So I'm thinking, and I'd like you folks and your commission to look and see whether we should maybe not just have the word advanced in there, but give the court a little broader jurisdiction to protect people who are under an age-related.
But since advanced is really interpretive, advanced or reduced?
No, that's not the term. I want to say reduced.
I was going to use the other one, but I didn't want to.
Infancy. Well, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be an infancy.
Age-dependent?
Situationally related.
Right.
It might be that somebody is over the age of majority, but for some reason has unduly very complex things and really is under even a medical disability, because although they may be over the age of 18 yesterday, they still are under the disability. I'd just like you to think about that and give us your thoughts. Through the chair.
Got it. Okay.
I'll try and through the chair, Representative Gruberg, I understand what you're saying, and, yeah, and I have a note here to I know Ms. Gibbons from the Department of Health and Social Services is an expert in this area, and I'll try.
Oh, I know you both will. I'm looking at both of you for that. Okay, I'm looking at you for that.
That's not fair.
Mr. Chair, I'll try and proceed. Section 5 adds attorneys, caregivers, and the Department of Health and Social Services as entities who may petition for conservatorship for an individual. The purpose of this is to widen the net of the individuals that can help protect victims, including those specific entities who likely have firsthand knowledge of the abuse. That's a fairly straightforward provision. Section 6, it creates the procedure for requesting the appointment of the temporary conservator by adding the new section to 1326.180. There is no statutory basis at the moment for appointing a temporary conservator, and I've had mixed experience with the courts asking me, well, I understand what you're asking for, but I can't find a specific statute to pin it to. It's not that they're saying, oh, no, we don't want to provide a remedy. It's more like we need the authority to do it.
May I inquire?
All right, just a second. Let him finish the sentence.
In most states, there is the explicit provision of temporary conservators allowed, and along the lines and for the reasons that we talked about a little earlier. It can appear you would go through the same procedure and the same threshold requirements. That is, if you file the petition, you have to show that the person is unable to effectively manage their own affairs. You have to show that they have property or assets that are in danger of waste or dissipation if relief is not granted. And then you get to the more specific need is, why does it need to be temporary? Well, it needs to be temporary because the harm being perpetrated is of an immediate nature. And it's not so much, in throughout history, the conservators have usually been used because an elder, due to age, dementia, whatever condition, is unable to effectively manage their finances. And there's been no implication or discussion of abuse. And when our conservatorship statutes were passed, that more or less typical situation was probably foremost in people's minds when they thought about what do we really need conservators for. This bill, this provision, is trying to respond to a new social reality, which is that financial exploitation of people in that position is on the increase. And by adding this, we can hopefully either prevent it or cure it.
Rachel Levitt, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I'm guessing you've been listening to the conversations.
Yes, I have.
What I'd like you to do is, if you feel you're able to contribute a significant point, to just jump on the air, and we'll give you a chance. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
I'll then proceed, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Representative Gruenberg?
I hope you'll allow questions as we deal with each section. That would be helpful, at least to me. Couple things here. I assume from what you've said, Mr. Sterling, that there is already specific statutory authority for a temporary guardian.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, that is correct.
Since Title 13, this portion of Title 13 is part of the Uniform Probate Code, as I recall, it would have seemed that when the commissioners on uniform state law were drafting that, they would have considered if they were doing, and guardianships and conservatorships kind of are one's for the person and the other's for the property. They sort of go hand in hand. I'm sort of surprised that they did not see the loophole that was being created by not having a provision in the statute for temporary guardianship. I wonder if this was something that was an oversight or just, you don't know, okay. The other question is, since some of the judges apparently are looking at this as a law that since it curtails somebody's liberty, must be strictly construed, and we're looking at here as this is a protective proceeding, which in the technical legal sense is remedial, whether there should be something that at least deals with, since the legislature can't put out all the details here, like whether the petition must specify the facts that would cause the termination of the temporary conservatorship, etc., whether we should have something that instructs the court that this is either a statute or a set of statutes that should be strictly construed, or whether because it's remedial it should be broadly construed, like the workers' comp. Workers' comp statutes have traditionally been broadly construed to protect the injured worker because they're remedial in nature, as opposed to criminal statutes, which are strictly construed. What is your intent with these, and do you think we should give more instructions to the court? Because we're going to obviously not be able to cover the waterfront. And if it's strictly construed, you may be coming back again and again for the judges who won't go that extra inch when it's obviously the intent that they've got to flesh this out. What do you folks think, through the chair?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I think that to be faithful to the existing statute that says the policy of the law is to find and impose only the least restrictive alternative, that I think the courts are very faithful to that standard. Mm. And that I think petitioners and advocates and parties need to bear that in mind. But when you look at existing statute on what conservators are authorized to do, the court has the power to fashion specific relief and to put limitations on powers, or to say the conservator shall only have the following enumerated powers in this order and no other. So our existing statute does permit for specific relief to be fashioned according to the harm and the remedies that are needed. So I've never had a problem with the broad versus strict interpretation, although I certainly understand your point. Okay. I'm of the belief that we should all adhere to what's in the legislature's command in the statute to begin with, which is least restrictive alternative. And if we stick with that, I think it helps us define the issues very tightly when you're presenting the situation of some person who you're saying, look, they need help, and here are the reasons why.
If I may follow up with one more question.
Please.
I'm going to withdraw that because we're going to go in more details here on temporary conservatorship.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, are we on number six?
We're on to number six, yes, Mr. Chair.
The words temporary basis
have occupied a lot
more than temporary time.
The thrust here is to make clear that the courts would have the authority as granted by the legislature to grant these temporary conservatorships, but that the legal standards that would apply would remain faithful to the least restrictive alternative policy. Section 7 adds two new statutes. The first is to make clear that the statutory basis for temporary conservators to protect the victims of fraud and financial abuse and to ensure that funds are obtained to meet the needs of the respondent, that would be the person who is the object of the petition, and or the respondent's dependents. And this statute is a mirror to the existing temporary guardian statute that's already in Title 13. The second statute in Section 7 creates a process for obtaining financial protective orders to immediately stop suspected financial abuse. This statute is constructed to permit any citizen to apply to a judge at any time and say, I have reason to believe that I am being financially exploited. I need the assistance of the court to put a stop to it on an emergency basis. It's intended to be used by people without access to legal services or for whom legal services are unaffordable and for whom access to courts is difficult or practically non-existent.
Well, the petitioner could be the affected party.
It's hopefully, in most cases, that would be the case, Mr. Chairman. The social reality underpinning to this is that financial exploitation is a form of domestic violence and abuse. And we have a very successful statute that helps our citizens combat domestic violence and receive the assistance of the courts. The time has now come to realize that we need to expand that to financial protection. Our experience in, you can call it statistics or whatever you want, but I'll just speak from experience. Clients I represent are people who, if we had this procedure, might have been able to put a stop to ongoing abuse before they finally got to my level, where they have an attorney where I can bring to bear advocacy for them. And from the perspective of preventing and combating financial exploitation, this helps preserve evidence. And I want to say that could not be more important, because preserving evidence is almost always in the form of financial records, transactions, and activities of persons who are perpetrating the harm. This protective order would help preserve evidence. And we've had many problems with evidence disappearing.
What comes to mind is, I'm behind in my rent. I go ask for protective order to keep my landlord from calling me. What happens?
Well, I think that you have to be able to show that you are actually suffering from fraud, and disputing with your landlord is, in theory, could be fraud, but you'd have to show more than just you disagree with your obligation to pay rent.
Is number 7 your last point on your side?
Yes, and I've used all our time. I feel
well, not a question in there, too.
Okay, let me just say what I'm going to do. We got some people online that have been waiting this entire time, so I'll let you ask your questions, and I'm going to go right online and get these people to make their comments, and then we'll suspend this bill till the next hearing. Representative Holmes?
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Subsection F of this on page 5, starting on line 16, it talks about third parties complying with the protective order and penalties for not complying. Who are we talking about? Can you give me some examples of what that means, what subsection F does, and who it applies to, who the third parties are?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes. The third parties most commonly will be financial institutions, medical and assisted living institutions, as well as immediate family members.
Which line do you want on that page?
Page 5, starting on line 16, subsection F, Mr. Chairman. And and I assume that it's included, even though it doesn't say in here, that obviously the third party would have to know about the protective order in order to be covered by subsection F or not. What's the how does that work? I mean, if it's an ex parte order, and so how does it work if it's if I'm a financial institution, how do I know the protective order is out there? Does it apply to me? I don't want to be civilly and criminally liable for something that I didn't know was out there. If you could walk me through that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, it is very analogous to the existing domestic violence procedure. That is, the order isn't binding on anyone until it's been duly issued by the court and placed in the Registry of Protective Orders by the Department of Public Safety. This is similar. once the order is issued by the court, however, the law, as it does in so many cases, says that the issuance of an order by a court is notice to the public that the order exists, and we're all bound to obey it. Whether we specifically, factually know about it, maybe not. But I would point out that as a practical matter, it's not going to help anyone too much to obtain this relief if they don't communicate it quickly to the people that matter. And it's similar in the domestic violence situation. Victims who obtain the orders are quite often very, you know, they want people to know it exists because they want people to know they're now protected by it.
Okay. Representative Thompson.
Yes, on the very start of Section 7, actually on page 4, about line 3, you've got down at, and a third party could be filing this. The court shall conduct a hearing within 72 hours after the filing. I was wondering, who's present at these hearings, and is the victim of fraud notified in all cases?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson. The if a person is filing, that would be the petitioner. If they file for the ex parte relief, they may be the only person present at the hearing. And that's only for the very limited 20-day initial period. If they want the order to be extended by the court beyond that, then there will be a hearing with notice to the affected party.
Follow-up question then.
Go ahead.
Since the victim is not necessarily physically or mentally disabled, shouldn't they have the right to be present when the state, for example, Health and Social Services, is attempting to take control of their money? I mean, shouldn't they have the right to be present, even if it's only a 20-day?
Well, if the state, through the chair, Representative Thompson, if the state, for example, filed for an ex parte order to help someone who has capacity, that would be highly unusual.
But it is open, isn't it?
I haven't heard of anyone doing it, but if the state or a third party is in a position of having to file for a person who lacks capacity, then it would be incumbent on you, to the extent you can, to bring the person to the hearing, because the judge or the magistrate will want to verify for the court's own satisfaction. It's not enough to just say, oh, they lack capacity, they can't tell you anything. You can't do that. You have to bring them there, and at least in guardianship and conservatorship proceedings, here, the paradigm or the typical case would be that an adult with sufficient awareness that they're being exploited, but without resources to have anywhere else to turn to put a stop to it, because, well, frankly, because technology now is so sophisticated, it's easy to steal from people. Wow. It's easy. Technology is outpacing the law, and it's outpacing law enforcement in this area. So this, if you're the person who's like, you know, how is it that I had $20,000 in my account yesterday and now I have $2,000? It's not a bank error in my favor, you know. It's because someone's figured out how to reach in and grab it. This is intended to say you can run to the nearest magistrate, and I also thought it would be important that it be available to everyone, urban and rural, places where you can call the magistrate in the village hub and make your application and get some help, where it's not an easy thing just to walk down the block to the courthouse.
Thank you.
I'm
going to thank you, and as I told you, we'll be back. But don't leave just yet, because the next thing we're going to do may take less time than I anticipate.
May I ask one very brief question, please?
It's got to be really brief, because we're already over.
And it's on the sentence that Representative Thompson was asking, the sentence on lines 3 and 4 on page 4. Given that we have such a big state, is it realistic that the court will be able to conduct a hearing always within 72 hours after the filing. Should we give them a little discretion in the matter, put if possible or something, because we might have somebody in a situation in the bush requiring something emergency, someplace like that. I'd like you to think about that, because you guys practice in this area, and I've had very little, I've done some, but not very much. I think it may not always be possible to do that, and I'd be prepared to work with you on that.
Through the chair,
does the term 72 hours mean exclusive of weekends, holidays, or does it mean 72 hours on the clock?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grubert, both. It means 72 hours on the clock.
Mm-hmm.
So you could run out of Saturday, Sunday, and holiday Monday. And
You could. The fact is it's intended to be 72 hours on the clock for the same reason that we have magistrates on duty to issue search warrants at any time of day or night.
All right. I'm going to shift to public testimony. We have one person. James Jewett, are you online?
I am.
Well, James, you have the floor. Can you give I got your name here. Can you tell us who you represent? Or, if anyone, just yourself?
Essentially, I'm representing myself.
Okay. Well, you have the privilege of the floor. Proceed.
As a full-time missionary in Africa for the last 3 years, home on leave, I discovered that some small marketing that I had attempted to do for the last 4 or 5 years was beyond the scope of what I was able to do effectively, and I responded to an ad, and I don't even remember exactly what the source of that original ad was, to do some internet marketing that would enhance my ability to move these resources. And that, on my part, for the sole purpose of expanding the mission work that I'm doing in Africa. And upon contacting these people, they told me that they had an opportunity that could, with just a few mouse clicks of the internet on a occasional basis, enhance my income greatly, and so I was a day or two before I convinced myself that I would pursue this a little farther. So when I talked with them again, they said, well, we can set you up a marketing page and presence on the internet that would be worldwide, and it would cost you only a few minutes every day or two, and no additional time or expense would be involved other than an initial investment. So it was my understanding that if I invested with them one time, it would be the end of it, and they would provide support and a marketing page and marketing support to increase a very good income that would support my ministry. And following this, I made an initial credit card investment of $17,000, which I thought was more than a little extravagant for what they were promising to me. And they said, well, you have 72 hours in which to contest it. This was on a late weekend evening, late at the week. Thursday night or Friday night, I don't remember which. So by Monday morning, I had mulled over the thought of what I had done, and I decided that I just didn't want to pursue it. So I called early and told them that I wanted to cancel my commitment with them, and they said, I'm sorry, Mr. Jewett, but your 72 hours have expired, and you no longer have that option. You are obligated for the rest of your life for this $17,000. And I tried and tried and tried and tried to back out, and was informed that I had no option to do that. So,
and you said this was a credit card charge?
Yes.
Did you call your credit card company?
This company took took my credit card account and assigned that $17,000 to it. And they told me that they would not honor the 72 hours, and I said, even though it's a weekend, and they said, your 72 hours have expired. You owe, period.
Now, my question is, did you, at that point, knowing all that you've told us, did you call your credit card company and say, stop that payment?
I did, and the credit card company said, well, we feel that you have entered into a legal agreement.
And so, can you tell us which card company that was?
Bank of America Visa.
Ouch. That's my company.
But anyhow, as time went on, they insisted to me, this representative insisted to me that just because I had spent $17,000 now, I really didn't have a business that was viable enough to produce the goods that needed to be done, so I needed to add some more services. And I said, I thought I was told that this one-time investment was all. Well, yeah, that's all you need to do with this, but if you're going to have a business that's going to pay, you have to do this and this. So as a matter of course, over the next few days, I was passed from one agency to another agency to another agency, each one of them insisting that without their particular service, this new company that I had started would be of no advantage to me whatsoever. And I was basically hard-handedly coerced into adding more and more and more charges to credit cards. And I wound up over a period of time with $41,000 plus. And thinking that I had this pretty well satisfied and settled and I would just go on about my business and conduct the business, and I knew that my ability to hear, because I'm very hard of hearing, communications are hard for me on the telephone, and my internet services in Africa are poor at best. I thought, well, I need someone here at home to watch over this business for me, so I engaged a young lady that I had been acquainted with to be my front person in this and see if we couldn't make it turn out to the best. So I went back to Africa on the last days of August of last year, and in the last days of September, barely a month later, my son called and said, Dad, you've got some serious problems at home and you have to come home now because of the financial situations. And so I was forced to leave an 8-month commitment in Africa to come back home, and I've been here ever since. And Scott Sterling, who is there with you today in your chambers, Mr. Chairman, can tell you that I have been pursuing this aggressively for all of these months. And numbers of the charges that these companies, all of them, 15 or more companies, all interrelated, some of them charging exactly the same receipt 2, 3, 4, 5 times from different agencies across different parts of the nation on the same receipt to me. It blows my mind that people can think they can do that.
Okay, Mr. Jewett, does that conclude your testimony?
Basically, yes. I can say that both state through the Elder Fraud Division with Mr. Sterling and federal agencies are involved in an ongoing investigation of these fraud charges that we have brought now because of it.
All right, thanks, Mr. Jewett. I appreciate your testimony. You have the attention of all the members on the committee as well as the audience.
Thank you, sir.
We're out of time, Max. With that, I'm going to get over now to seven amendments that go to House Bill 127.
Mr. Chairman. if I may, one thing.
Sure.
Ms. Hendrickson brought to my attention the 72-hour period does not include weekends. I was wrong about that.
How about Memorial Days and Labor Days and also?
I don't think it includes.
Official holidays and weekends are excluded.
Weekends and holidays are excluded. So I was wrong about that. I wanted to make sure we got that correction.
First time?
Last time.
Representative Gruenberg?
When we take the bill up again, I would like, if it's at all relevant, to hear from your point of view the Jewett situation, and if we need to look at that legislatively, whether in this bill or something else. I personally had a father-in-law in a similar situation, and it was quite serious, right. And I'm sure other people have. I know you are interested in this too, Mr. Chairman, I think, from what I've seen. And this is something, whether it's in this bill or something else, both of you, because you're the Attorney General involved too, let's see if we can do something, if we need to do something. This is serious stuff that's happening to Alaskans.
I think I've won a dozen lotteries and been inherited 15 different million-dollar inheritances.
A brand new car is waiting for you on the dock. You just have to pay a few fees and right. It'll be delivered.
Right. Okay, so with that, we'll return to this bill, I'm sure, next time we meet. So let's go to House Bill 127. There are seven amendments that we want to. Is this for? What's this one for? Oh my goodness!
Yes. 127.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We're going to get to these amendments first.
Yes.
So, do you have the stack of amendments labeled A.1 through A.7?
Two, three.
Yes, sir. Yep.
We have through five.
You have one through five only.
I'm looking at five.
Dot six and dot seven.
Don't have it in my packet right on.
Okay. Well, we'll start early and we'll get to them.
Okay.
So, why don't we have?
I have all.
You have six and seven. Okay. Actually, she's bringing them to me.
Representative Pruitt, do you have all seven?
I have all seven.
I'm going to ask if you would then move one at a time.
Okay.
So beginning with A.1.
That's by Representative Lynn.
Pardon me? Oh, okay. I do have. Let me just let that go.
Yeah, Representative
Lynn. That's his name on it. I'm sorry. That may be the only one where we have a name.
No, number two, it looks like it's Representative Thompson.
There we go. Okay, Representative Lynn.
I'm out in the open with this amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I move amendment number one.
Representative Lynn has moved amendment number one. Is there an objection?
I'll object for discussion at least, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Holmes objects. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. some of you on this committee and other committees may recall that I had a false caller ID bill here.
Yes.
At one time, and that involves a telephone caller ID. Most of us have one way or another. And there's technology out there readily available and very cheap where you can change the name that appears on your caller ID at your house. And that opens the door to all kinds of mischief, including mischief that would involve sexual predators. And that bill passed this committee and passed out of the House, and it got stuck in the innards of the other body. That be as it may, this amendment that I'm putting forth here would bring a portion of that into this bill. There have been reports out there that sexual predators have changed their caller ID, making it a false caller ID to match a local school or police department. Then they can call the parents to determine when their kid is going to be left alone. And there are other varieties where false caller ID could open the door to sexual abuse of kids and others. Secondly, I want to make sure that we can throw the book at these online predators who lie about their identities through false caller ID and endanger Alaska's kids. And I think this amendment simply gives the prosecutor another tool in a toolbox to work with. And thirdly, I want to give prosecutors a lesser but still serious charge that they can level at somebody to plead out cases where they may not have enough evidence for the
for the actual sex offense, but they can go to trial on the false caller ID part. And our office has, in fact, worked, or my staffer, Thomas Reicher here, has done that, where Doug Gardner, who's the new director of Legislative Legal, to draft this amendment, and Mr. Gardner himself is, in fact, a former prosecutor, and hopefully he's online who can address any concerns or questions that the committee might have. Finally, this amendment doesn't create any new crime or any new mandate for any prosecution by the Department of Law. It simply elevates criminal impersonation, such as caller ID, to a second-degree Class B felony. And that's about it. I urge your support. I think it's a good bill. I think it fits here.
Ms. Carpinetti, would you take the stand, please?
Yeah. And I'd like to, if we could, Mr. Gardner on also, so the two legal eagles can discuss this.
Would this amendment create additional costs?
Mr. Chairman, that's a tough question because I don't know whether how often we would be able to prosecute under this statute. I you know, I really appreciate Representative Lynn's concern about this conduct. I understand. I know that it's serious. We're just having a little trouble understanding this placement in this.
And are we violating single subject rule?
I don't think so. Mr. Chairman. But this statute is in the forgery section of our property crimes. So maybe I'm a little hidebound, but most sex offenses are in either title chapter 41 or 61. 41 is crimes against a person. 61 is crimes involving, illegal photographs or taping or child pornography. So I'm having a little bit of trouble getting our arms around it. I know the intent is good and it's a creative idea. It just doesn't seem to be a happy fit to us in this particular statute. It creates this conduct is a Class B felony, and it provides that if you misrepresent yourself with intent to commit a crime, a sex offense, you can be prosecuted as under this statute, this provision at a Class B felony level. But one of the problems is it defines sex offense as it brings in the definition of sex offense in our sex offender registration statutes, which includes attempts, and it includes some misdemeanor offenses. Mm. So that under this statute, if you misrepresent yourself with intent to commit a sex crime, which could be intent to commit an attempt, you could be prosecuted for a Class B misdemeanor.
Felony.
I'm sorry, yes, Class B felony. Or if you misrepresented yourself. And in other ways besides caller ID, I mean, this it uses as a basis criminal impersonation, which just means taking a false identity, not necessarily by telephone, but by any means, you know, telling somebody you're a wealthy physician and therefore they should have a drink with you, not taking a false identity and intending to do something else with it. And so we're kind of concerned about it. Not that we don't think it would be a good idea. We have worked with the sponsor on his false caller ID bills, but we would prefer it be a standalone section, not necessarily in our forgery provisions. Having said that, I do honor the intent, and I know it's bad behavior. There are circumstances where this would be an attempt to commit a sex crime, which we would much prefer see, because that's what we do. We have sex crimes and we have property crimes, and this is a little bit of a mixing up of the two. And so that's our position on it. We think it's a great idea to address this behavior. We would prefer seeing it in a standalone section.
Okay. I'm going to set it aside for now. Let's go to Amendment A2, Representative Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept Amendment A2.
A2 is before us. Representative Holmes has objected. Representative Thompson.
Yes, this is referencing page 3 of the original bill on line 7. After the person insert is, and then on line 8 after A, eliminate is, on line 11 after B, eliminate has been, and on line 14 after C, eliminate has been, so that it would read then that the person is registered, charged, bringing it up to present tense instead of the has-beens.
Representative Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, I think that addresses one of the concerns we'd had, and if nobody else, if everyone's okay, I will remove my objection.
Objection is removed. Representative Gruenberg?
For the purpose of discussion, I'm going to put an objection on this for a second, and I'm going to ask Ms. Carpinetti. When Ms. Staft and I talked about this before the hearing this afternoon, something tickled the back of my mind. And the question is, I support what the intent of the amendment does, but I'm asking Ms. Carpinetti, has the Department of Law completely thought this through to make sure that it goes, it's got the Goldilocks effect, since they're using that in astronomy now, that it goes far enough and not too far and is just right? I'm going to withdraw my objection, but, and this bill's got a ways to go, but I'd like the department to carefully look at the wording here and make certain that it's a Goldilocks amendment and it doesn't either not go far enough or go too far. And I have, my thoughts are no farther crystallized than that. Have you guys looked at this really carefully, or do you feel, or am I just on the
Chair, Representative Gruenberg, I understand, I understand what you mean. I guess when I discussed this amendment with Rick Sobotny, my boss, we were always under the impression that that's how it would be interpreted, as is under charge or indictment. Because if a person is convicted, they would have to, they would come under paragraph A, already covered, is being required to be registered as a sex offender or a child kidnapper. And these are sex offenses that require registration. So when you read the present language, and this is current statute, this bill doesn't change this language, but when you read it, it is possible to interpret it as being a person who has been uncharged and, in fact, acquitted.
And we don't want to do that.
Right.
May I just inquire one further thing on this?
Yeah.
Is Mr. Steiner or Ms. Leavitt or any of those folks on the line, I'm going to ask them the same question from the opposite point of view. Are they certain that this it doesn't have any unintended consequences?
Quinlan Steiner, public defender, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner with the Public Defender Agency.
And will you yeah, go ahead.
In answer to Representative Gruenberg's direct question, I haven't had this amendment long enough to determine that there aren't any unintended consequences. I don't immediately see any particular problem with Amendment A.2, but I just got them a couple hours ago.
Mr. Chair, with that, I'm going to withdraw my objection, but would ask all of these agency representatives to let us know down the road if they further consider this so that we can make certain that we do what you intend, Representative Thompson. With that, I withdraw my objection.
Okay. Is there any other objection? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment A2 is adopted. Moves us to A3. Representative Pruitt, would you like to move Amendment A3?
I move for purposes of discussion Amendment A3.
Object to discussion.
And Representative Holmes has objected, so you'll have to do that. No, you don't. Representative Holmes, would you address the objection that you have for us,
or was it time to read it? It's just for somebody to quickly put on the record what it is we're doing. Maybe Ms. Carpinetti could do that. I'm not sure if she or.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It was suggested to us by the Division of Juvenile Justice. This bill raises from a Class B to a Class A felony, unlawful exploitation of a minor and online I'm sorry, unlawful exploitation of a minor under 1141-455. By doing so, it brings it within the auto waiver provisions of Title 47. Under Title 47-12-030, Class A felonies against a person and unclassified felonies for committed by 16 and 17-year-old minors are automatically waived to adult court without going through the juvenile system. And the thought was that these type of offenses would probably be more suitable for treatment by the juvenile justice system. And, in fact, there is a discretionary waiver provision in our statutes which would allow them to be waived under circumstances which would justify it, but this would just say that it would not be automatically waived to adult court.
Okay. We have Troy Newman here, or is it Tony? Tony Newman? Did you want to comment on this?
Just here to answer questions.
Got it. Right. Juvenile Justice in the back to answer questions if we have juvenile justice questions. Okay. With that, we have A3 in front of us.
Mr. Chairman, if there are no other comments, I will remove my objection.
Objection has been removed. Any new objections? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment A3 is adopted. We'll go to A4. Do we know who offered A4 by any chance?
Jane was saying something.
Why? Government of what? DOL? Okay. Well, we have a DOL.
Yeah, this is the subpoena power. This was Andy's amendment. Yeah.
All right.
Yes. It was, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for considering this amendment to the bill.
I'll move the amendment.
Yeah.
Representative Pruitt.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment A4 for purposes.
Chairman, I'll object for discussion.
Representative Holmes has objected.
Mr. Tarpanetti. Chairman, members of the committee, last year in Senate Bill 222 and House Bill 298, the legislature passed a bill addressing sex offenses and child exploitation offenses. And one of the provisions in that bill that was added in the middle of the session was a provision suggested by the Department of Public Safety to allow them to obtain administrative subpoenas from Internet service providers to get certain information about individuals.
And they resisted, no doubt.
Well, I have to say that administrative subpoenas, although they are very common in our statutes for various people to obtain, are not particularly familiar to the criminal division of the Department of Law. And there are some problems with the law that was passed last year that this amendment addresses. And these include the following. Well, first of all, the current law only allows the Attorney General to issue such a subpoena, and it doesn't specifically allow his or her designee to do so. And that's a problem because, you know, our Attorney General is not always available, and one of the main purpose of this is to obtain information in a quicker fashion than would be possible for to get a search warrant.
There
so that is a problem. And as we read over the history of the legislation, the only history that we saw was a statement that it would be at the Attorney General level. So this amendment allows our Attorney General to appoint a designee for these to issue these subpoenas.
And that's on line 14.
Line 17.
It's on 14 and 17.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, may I inquire?
Gruenberg?
How will the designation be done administratively? Is there some official, does it go in some kind of a publication or something, or is it just an order that they do? How does this work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruenberg, I think it would be just a written designation. That's okay. I may be mistaken on that, and if I am, I can find out, but I think it would be a written designation.
Dan Cliff's nodding. Yeah, okay. So for the record, Public Safety Liaison thinks it would be just a written document.
Okay. The second concern we had with what was passed last year is that it's provided for service according to the court rules, civil rules 4 and 45, which allow for service by certified mail or by personal service by a law enforcement officer. And that isn't fast either. That is relatively slow methods of service. Under federal law, the federal government and investigators have these subpoenas, and they fax them. to Internet service providers, which is a perfectly fine way to do it as long as the service provider accepts service. So we just pull that out and will allow these administrative subpoenas to be served in any way that is reasonable under the circumstances. And if it's not, you know, the person, if they don't accept service, then we can deal with it that way. So it removes that specific provision addressing service, which is really a hampering, ties the hands of law enforcement.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I see it, Ms. Carpinetti, through the chair, that you're focusing on one word on line 17, may issue an administrative subpoena. It doesn't define the method of issuance. Am I missing anything in the text of the amendment itself, or is that the only term that refers to the method by which the subpoena will be served?
I think you're probably right. Let me just look at it really
now,
quickly.
Now, if that is the case, It seems to me it would be imperative on the AG to issue a regulation setting forth how these will be served. So it's not just on an ad hoc basis, because from a due process point of view, it's very important legally that legal service is served properly and in accord with law. And if we use the word issue here, I don't think it's clear that they must do it by regulation, which would be pursuant to the rulemaking procedures under the Administrative Procedures Act, I assume. I think we should say, if we're not going to define the method of service any further, that they should have to promulgate that in at least a regulation, and we should say or something that would say may issue as in a manner prescribed by regulation or something like that. And my question then would be, are you guided by the provisions of the APA and how you promulgate your regulations? I assume the answer would be yes.
Yes, through the chair. Okay. Yes, well, I would say that, first of all, the Attorney General is obliged to follow A, which he can't issue a subpoena unless there's a reasonable cause to believe that an Internet service provider has used...
I'm not talking about the cause. I'm talking about the method of service.
Well, that's an interesting... And I think it's a reasonable suggestion through the chair. The other statutes that I've looked at that allow for administrative subpoenas do not say that, do not address that particularly. But I would be happy to look into it.
We want to move the bill today.
Well, we may not unless we're ready to. In a manner as prescribed by the Office of the Attorney General?
By regulation.
And we just amend the amendment?
Yeah, that would be my thought.
I think that is a reasonable thing to suggest, and then if it turns out, I mean, I don't see any reason why we couldn't adopt a regulation addressing how it would be done. I mean, we would be probably guided by the federal prosecutors who do it by fax, or I suppose in the future we might even need to do it by email, scanning a subpoena into a computer. Mm-hmm. But I think it might be wise to just
through the chair. I just want this to withstand a constitutional challenge, and all of the lawyers who've taken civil procedure in their first year remember the U.S. Supreme Court cases that deal with whole things getting thrown out because people weren't served right. I'm going to offer a conceptual amendment to the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Good.
And it would be on line 17,
page
1. May issue in a manner prescribed by regulation an administrative subpoena. So between issue and, it would be the phrase, in a manner prescribed, prescribed, by regulation. And that's a conceptual amendment that Mr. Gardner and the crew, in conjunction, and I'm looking at Sarah here, in conjunction with Ms. Carpinetti, and my office is happy to help,
come up with language that would basically do that, and that's my amendment, number one to the amendment.
Now, is that automatically a directive to develop the regulation, or what happens if, I mean, how do we guarantee that we get a regulation?
That, Mr. Chair, in my specific intent, that before they do this, they must issue a regulation which would be under the rulemaking procedures of the Administrative Procedures Act. It's all set out there. They draft it and they publish it in the state publication, and then they take public comment and it becomes effective. But that way there is no constitutional question that this is done right.
Mr. Chairman, we couldn't issue such a subpoena without having a regulation that we, if this, I mean.
So you're okay. Yeah, we want to blame somebody.
Of course we want to be fair. We want to do it in a way that everybody understands is a fair way of service. At this point, I wouldn't object until I have a chance to talk to other people in my office to see if there is a problem. I don't think there should be one. We can adopt it. Just be a delay in adopting the regulation.
We'll probably bring this back up in our next meeting, and we'll have a CS, and we'll amend the CS if we have to.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
that would be great. That's okay with me.
Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, my question's on the underlying amendment, not the amendment to the amendment. Nobody objected to the amendment to the amendment, so I assume it passed.
I move the amendment to the amendment.
Is there an objection to the amendment to the amendment? Seeing, hearing, and hearing none, the amendment to the amendment is adopted. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just wanted to make sure we were procedurally got our ducks in a row. My question, Ms. Carpinetti, is the Attorney General's designee. First of all, I assume that would have to actually be within the Department of Law?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. And second, Mr. Chairman, could there be more than one at a time? I'm assuming it would be that the Attorney General would have a written order in there saying, this is my designee for purposes of this. Is that limited to one person? Could they designate multiple people? Could they designate any attorney in the Department of Law? Do we know what that means?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holmes, we envision it just being one person. It's kind of a delicate matter because you don't want to be allowing district attorneys to issue these subpoenas because they're the ones that are working on the case, and that doesn't seem enough of a separation. There are several lawyers in our department that significantly removed from prosecution that would be more suitable. And then if you have one person doing it in the absence of the Attorney General, they get experience that's what we're envisioning now is one individual who would be available to police officers in their investigations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question? Done? Objections all removed?
No more questions. So I'll remove my objection.
So with no objections, amendment A.4 as amended conceptually is adopted. Moves us to A.5.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt amendment A.5.
Do we know who offered this one?
We'll object for discussion.
A.5. All right, we have A.5 in front of us. There is an objection from Representative Holmes. Address this.
I actually put the words on paper after a meeting with your staff members, the staff members of everybody in.
It's a group project, Mr. Chairman.
I will take responsibility for its content, but I fortunately can share it with many people.
I'm going to interpose an objection too, because I have some concern about the language.
Just a second. Did you object?
I already
have an objection.
Discussion.
Okay. And you haven't withdrawn it yet, so Representative Gruenberg?
When my staff and I talked about this just moments before the meeting, and I'm sorry I wasn't involved with the drafting, the key phrase, and I very much applaud the intent of the amendment and the work that's gone into this, intent to annoy or embarrass another person. What I came up with was you could have a baby picture that is transmitted by one
teenager about another or whoever, and they want to embarrass the person or maybe even annoy them, but it's not a criminal intent. It's a kidding kind of a thing, you know, like, hey, look at how my buddy looked when he was 6 months old, or my wife did, or whoever. It's not with criminal intent. And I was thinking, rather than the term annoy or embarrass, something like with criminal malice.
Through the chair, I'm concerned about that term. We don't use that term.
We
do have, for example, malicious mischief in our statutes, but that is defined with terms with our normal or our statutorily defined culpable mental states. Mm-hmm. That's just the name of the crime. I would have some concerns with using the term with criminal malice.
May I inquire? I'm no pride in authorship there, but I'm just concerned that you could want to embarrass somebody, but there's no evil intent.
Through the chair, this is a difficult section to draft. If the culpable mental state for harassment is with intent to annoy or harass, one of the reasons why it was decided that we shouldn't include that in harassment, we shouldn't include this in harassment, is because we wanted to introduce the concept of intent to embarrass somebody, which is what I think a lot of this conduct will be, and we didn't want to change that intent for all of the harassment sections, which would be a big change to our harassment law.
Through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Around here, we're friends, and in life, you know, we kid around and embarrass each other. I get embarrassed. I embarrassed other people.
And I'm suing you.
Yeah, you know, seriously, we're going to have some people who have very thin skin or one person's hide is thick.
But have to prove intent to embarrass, not just that you did, but that you intended to.
I understand, but you could intend to embarrass me or I you. That doesn't make it criminal. You know, embarrassment is a very low threshold. Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I move that we table this amendment until the next time we meet to try to come up with a better term. I think embarrassment is a very low standard.
Well, I would respond just through the chair that we would have to prove the intent to annoy or embarrass, and it wouldn't be the person whose photographic would be who would be making the decision. It would be a prosecutor who has discretion not to prosecute.
What I'd like to do is vote on this amendment, and it'll come back as a CS, and that would be an opportunity to give a couple of days worth of time to figure out how to modify the terms, if indeed that would help.
That would help. With that understanding, what's your objection? I won't interpose another one, but I...
Representative Holmes?
I'm just not satisfied.
Mr. Chairman, I know we only have a minute or two left.
We're going to hang here until we get through this.
Okay.
Six and seven.
I was hoping that maybe we could, I agree with what Representative Gruenberg's saying, but I also like the direction the amendment has been going. But I was hoping that we kind of skipped over the part where Ms. Carpinetti was going to give us a quick overview of what this, the changes in this amendment. There were a few other changes in this amendment that we didn't go over.
Did you want to wait till next meeting or go over time now? And because we're going to be able to amend it, we'll get an explanation, we'll still be able to amend the CS.
If the purpose, Mr. Chairman, is to get the CS ready, then I'll remove my objection, and we can take up the discussion. We'll take up all this discussion at the next. I will remove my objection.
Objection is removed. Is there another objection to A.5? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment A.5 is adopted. That brings us to A.6.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt Amendment A.6.
A.6 is before us. Is there an objection to A.6? And I'll give you
very
a moment.
Briefly for...
I'll give you some time. Representative Holmes, objection?
Mr. Chairman,
what does this do?
You don't have 6?
Mr. Chairman, I think I can, having objected, I think I can explain what 6 does.
Yeah.
this is on page 2, lines 13 and 14. We had in there, we were talking about installing devices on vehicles and computers and et cetera, and we had a concern that by saying the vehicle of that person or the computer of that person, that you would not pick up the situation where maybe my dad owns the car or my husband or wife, and so used by, it would be the residence, vehicle, or workplace used by the person. And so I think this is an attempt to clean up and make
much
sure
improved,
that...
Correct. Representative Grunberg.
I'm not going to object today, but there was something that's been at the back of my mind on this provision here, sub I, on page 2, lines 11 to 14. And that is, sometimes lawyers and others employ private investigators. Mm-hmm. And we had a bill to license PIs. Bob Roses introduced it a couple legislatures ago. Bill didn't go anywhere, but it was as part of a national effort by the PIs to professionalize their mm-hmm. profession. And we have not gotten any input on this from either the legal profession or the PIs. I'm not going to object today, but I'm looking at Gretchen on my staff. We need to get some input on this that we're not seriously impinging on the legitimate activities of that profession.
Got it.
Through the chair, could I just respond? This is a definition of non-consensual conduct for our stalking statutes.
Oh.
In order to prove stalking, we have to prove that somebody behaved within, that a person was put in fear of death or serious bodily injury. So this is very limited. This only is a definition in the stalking section. It's part of the definition of, it's the definition of non-consensual conduct. It's part of the definition of course of conduct, but we would also have to prove that the person knowingly engaged in a course of conduct that recklessly places another in fear of death or serious bodily injury.
I withdraw my objection. Thanks for putting that on the record.
Okay.
I will then withdraw my objection.
So with the objection withdrawn, is there another objection? Seeing and hearing none, Amendment A.6 is adopted. That brings us to our final amendment, A.7, Representative Pruitt.
This was something that I brought up, so I'll...
Okay, we'll let Representative Grunberg move the amendment.
This was a typographical error.
I move
the amendment.
Move amendment number A.6. Typographical error, according to Representative Grunberg, if becomes of. Is there an objection to amendment number A.7? Seeing and hearing none, A.7 is adopted. That concludes our work for today. It was set aside. Yeah, that could. Thank you for reminding me about that. Amendment number 1 was set aside. Ms. Carpinetti, could you give me your opinion on what we should do with amendment number A.1? You said it's in the wrong place. Not that it's the wrong amendment, but... It would need to be relocated. I hesitate to put it in the CS if it mm-hmm. doesn't belong in the CS in this.
This puts me in an awkward position. You know, I really understand and admire the sponsor of the amendment. I would rather see it in a standalone bill if you ask my, that's my personal opinion.
Okay. Representative Lynn?
I would... ask at some point, either today or next hearing, that Mr. Gardner, new director of Les Legal, speak to the issue. It's really a legal matter, you know,
what?
Between attorneys.
Yeah, come forward and thank you.
I don't think we've ever met, Mr. Gardner.
I have spoken with you on the phone, Representative Grunberg. Good to see you here.
It's very nice. This is a great opportunity.
Here it is. This is all home week here.
The question through the chair, as I understand it, is this amendment in the correct spot? And I'll have to...
Oh, I'm sorry. You'll have to introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And your title.
Move the mic. My name's Doug Gardner. I'm Director of Legal Services for the legislature.
And you, whose place did you take?
I took Tam Cook's place.
Place.
Well, nobody
okay,
can take
so
Tam Cook's place, but
stand
I'm attempting to fill those shoes. Thank you, Representative Gatto. The question that I understand was being put to my former colleague in the criminal division, Ms. Carpinetti, was whether or not this amended language is in the right place. I guess the question that occurred to me is when you look at the statute as it's currently drafted, I think there's a fair reading of the statute. You read 1146.570, if a person assumes a false identity and does so and doesn't act in that assumed character with the intent to commit a crime, if that crime is a sexual offense, I would submit to the committee that it's already potentially a crime. You could charge it that way. And you've been a prosecutor for 9 years. I'm guessing that a prosecutor would be less likely to do that because this would be a misdemeanor as it would be currently cognizable under the statute as it is. I would submit that this amendment makes it a B felony to do that if the intent of the act is to commit a sex offense. I guess I can't comment on the policy consideration as to where it is. I would observe, however, though, that 1146, 565, and 570 encompass quite a large number of acts that could include a misuse of Craigslist or Facebook or the caller ID, as Representative Lynn discussed earlier. So one way to look at this is that this language makes, if the intended crime is a sex offense, it gives a prosecutor another option to prosecute under. It may be the case that, and I understand that an attempted sex crime would certainly be more serious, but in order to prove an attempted sexual assault or an attempted SAM 1, sexual abuse of minor in the first degree, you'd have to also include proof of a substantial step towards committing that offense. In this crime, this would be an offense that wouldn't include that element. I could conceive of a situation where somebody does some type of a caller ID scam, as Representative Lynn discussed, or did something on Facebook, mm-hmm. where it might not quite get to the point where it's a substantial step, but it might be a very serious issue that could be addressed under the statute with the amendment or without the amendment as a misdemeanor. That's how I answer the question of placement and the logic of the amendment. I'm trying to be careful. I spent 10 years as an advocate, so I'm not trying to advocate, but I'm trying to explain the.
You may have been too careful because I'm not sure I've been able to reach my own conclusion as to does it belong here or does it not. And that was really the original question.
Mm-hmm. And that's a policy consideration, certainly, for the committee. I'm just observing
We make those decisions based on testimony that we receive from people that we know and trust to help us organize our own voting. We have two lawyers on the committee, but we don't have seven. So go back to the original question. Does this amendment, is the public best served by placing amendment number A1 in this section? Or in the bill, of the bill, okay. Or is the public better served by holding it, making a standalone bill, and placing it where it would maybe even fit better? Because we can do either one with probably equal effort.
And Chairman Gatto, I guess that's a hard question to answer. I would submit this, though, in the premise of my comments before were that I think that the conduct could constitute a violation of the section as it is, albeit with a lot less consequence as a misdemeanor instead of a felony. So I think generally there is an effort made not to duplicate a similar situation in another statute, and I think that was the idea behind amending the existing statute to avoid adding another number to Title 11.
Representative Holmes,
If I may weigh in, Mr. Chairman, I'm sufficiently confused that my personal opinion at this point would be I'd rather not see it in the CS at this point while I puzzle through just my 2 cents worth of this at 3:10 in the afternoon.
I agree with you, and I'm sure Representative Grunberg is probably agreeing with you.
May I make a motion, please?
Hold on.
Sorry.
Let me get some statement out here that...
Sorry.
Unless we were certain that... what to do with A.1, I think it's better to hold it back, get a CS, and if A.1 is not going to fit in, it's just not going to fit. This is a long-term effort, not an emergency for us. And so standalone bill with just 8.1, I'm okay with. I think we probably have a couple of our lawyers here that are okay with. Is there anybody on the committee besides Representative Lynn that would prefer that we take this question up now and vote on it? Representative Grunberg.
I would make a suggestion. I would move to table this until we deal with the bill again next Monday or whatever. Keep it on the table, and we can then think about it over the weekend, what we want to do, and maybe get some further comments from the experts on this, rather than making a decision at this point. And with the permission of the chair and the maker of the amendment, I'd like to just delay that to a time certain next time we deal and take this up at that time.
Yes. We would have to vote on that, but go ahead. Representative Lynn,
on
whether or not to table it.
Unless there's objection.
Oh, well, I would like to see it entered, obviously. I think mm-hmm. it has a better chance of getting in there if we table it and we can discuss it further.
Yeah. If we just don't include it here and don't table it, and you have to make a separate bill for it, you've got to start all over from ground zero, and yes. It might be a struggle. And that may still be the best alternative, but we should at least take Representative Grunberg's suggestion, table the bill, and take it up a little bit later, hopefully not after the weekend,
tabled,
but before
the
that.
Amendment's tabled to a time certain when the bill comes up again.
Okay, so Representative...
I make that happen.
I just don't object to my motion.
Motion.
My motion, Mr. Chair...
I move to table A.1.
Until the bill comes up again.
And do you need the words time certain?
No, just an event is okay.
Okay. Is there an objection to tabling?
No objection.
Without objection, that bill is... A.1 is then tabled. Is there any other... conversation that the committee wants to move forward? I don't think we've closed public testimony either, have we? Fine. That's the way I wanted it done. With that, we are adjourned.